This is the Saxo Market Call, daily insights on what is moving the financial markets.
Well, welcome everyone to the Saxo Market Call. It is Wednesday, 28th of April, 2021. And while the equity session looked pretty boring on the headlines, so we have an interesting development in Treasury markets. We'll get to Altea on that in a moment, but U.S. Treasury yields actually jumping quite a bit higher around the time of the seven-year auction yesterday. And this clearly spooked or saw some patterns in the equity market where you're seeing the interest rate sensitive stocks, Peter, underperforming clearly, and some of those being the more speculative names. But the NASDAQ 100 still looking a bit in range there and a bit more vulnerable than the S&P 500. You've got that big pivot area around the 13,700 level and 13,750, which is where the 21-day moving average is. Of course, we need to get there for this to be a negative development, and I've noticed some divergent momentum. But what's your take on the session yesterday, also in light of some pretty strong earnings and spots?
Yeah, so the earnings were a little bit more mixed in the U.S. with disappointments across Amgen, Pinterest, and Microsoft. And then you had the Alphabet really as a positive in the U.S., but we'll talk about that later. In Europe, the story this morning is still very strong earnings against expectations with Deutsche Bank, which is raising its outlook. It's close to a high stock price there for over the past 3 years. So it really looks like Deutsche have turned a corner here for the better, although Q1 was really, saw the tailwind of capital markets. Profits that they don't expect to carry into Q2. And then Delivery Hero basically just blasting consensus estimates. I mean, their gross merchandise value was almost twice than what market expected. And they are expecting very aggressive or a 6.6 billion in revenue for this year, which is 40% higher than where the market is. It's just incredible. And Carlsberg and Banco Santander is also out. So the story is that I would say on the margin, Europe's corporate sector is doing better than the US. You correctly said, you can see that on the insert on slide three, the really interest rate sensitivity stocks were, down, leading the declines. And so maybe that story is coming back to life, and it very much pins on where Altea area, the fixed income market, takes rates and inflation. It's still, I would say, arguably the biggest question together with the commodity prices is that cluster there that will drive equities. So, that's our focus. But I think the Eurostoxx 50, it could potentially touch 4,000 very soon and then push through. I still have a positive view here in the short term, but it all comes down to those interest rates.
Okay, interest rates. Altea, that's your cue. I mean, we saw, on the headline and relative to the recent range, this seven-year auction was not stellar, but it wasn't a new week level, certainly not like that one that really spooked the market back in a couple months ago. But what's your take on whether this was the actual main cause of the big spike in yields and then the auction itself?
Well, John, I think that the market was expecting a weaker seven-year note auction yesterday. And the fact that bidding metrics were in line with the previous auction didn't change the fact that the market still see the risk for FOMC meeting today, where economic outlook is going to be discussed, and also inflation. So the take here is that if you look at slide number 4 at the chart on the left, it shows the 10 years US Treasury yield. And as you can see, yields didn't break below the 50-day moving average, and sentiment continues to be bearish. So yields are still trending on the upside. So our take here, my take here, is that today with the FOMC meeting, there is plenty of risk to see yields resuming a rise to break above the 1.70 resistance line. And at that point, the next resistance level that we would find is around 2%. So just, John, just quickly on the Fed meeting, what the bond market and bond investors should focus on is the economic outlook, And whatever the hint where they expect inflation to be. And if there is any guidance, are they going to set any kind of scenarios in terms of if inflation goes there, then we might need to change our policies?
Yeah, I think that debate is certainly coming. I wonder, though, at this meeting, my position has been, I think that's kind of the consensus, to be fair, is that it's just they're in this period where it's really awkward for them. They're saying, well, we expect XYZ to be transitory, and it's too early to say whether it's transitory or not. So it's going to be really difficult to sort of roll out that debate and scenarios. I bet the June meeting with this, the coming forecast that you'll see at the June meeting for the FOMC, where you see that they're forced to actually come up with a forecast on the economic and policy front. That's where the debate might really start. But of course, the market would be very shocked if the statement does see a bit more discussion, bringing in the topics you discussed there. And then yesterday you recorded a fixed income webinar. The recording for that will be available at some point today. It wasn't up the last I checked, but it generally takes about a day for these to be posted. There was one chart you pulled out this morning. I don't know if you discussed it on your webinar, talking about triple C spreads were basically down at historic lows. Is that a big focus for you as well in the corporate credit space?
Yeah, it's true that right now junk bonds are very expensive. And in the webinar, I compare junk corporate bonds with emerging market sovereigns. And the conclusion I draw is that, unfortunately, right now, the only place where to hide in the fixed income market is still junk.
Right. Interesting stuff. Also, because some of those historic, of course, you know, historically low spreads have been just before the spreads start to widen, which of course means when credit is going the wrong way, that's a leading indicator for problems afoot elsewhere. Let's look at a couple other markets where this yield move really got the attention of players in the market. And the most sensitive in foreign exchange, no big surprise, in Japanese yen. You can see the chart on slide 6. So that Ichimoku cloud level proved very ideal. We never closed in the cloud. And then of course, this pop in US yields, we're seeing it rushing back higher. You can draw all kinds of Fibonacci retracement levels, et cetera, but it really is, it just seems the moment that yen traders only have a nose for the direction in US yield. So we need to keep track of that. And then on slide, actually, I don't really have a segue for it, but I just noticed in the economic data rolling in recently, yesterday, we had another huge advance in US consumer confidence data that suggests an underlying strong jobs market. That's gonna be interesting to see the claims data in coming weeks on this. You can see the blue line on slide 7 is the U.S. consumer confidence data, just about getting back into the range of pre-pandemic. So quite a remarkable recovery there. And contrast that with a very disappointing GFK consumer confidence read out of the U.K. this morning, where that improvement that was expected did not happen. We actually saw declining confidence for the so-called May data round for that one. So I don't have any explainer there. I just wanted to note it, and we'll follow up on that. And finally, on FX, we had a very weak Australian CPI report for Q1 overnight. The quarter on quarter on the headline only out at 0.6% versus the 0.9% expected. And if the core only 0.3 versus 0.5. I'm a bit surprised given, Ulle, actually the action in your space, the commodities price is coming down for the key Australian linked commodities, the metals markets, et cetera, combined with this weaker CPI, didn't see an even bigger reaction in the Aussie, but certainly if you look at Aussie dollar, a chart on slide 8 there, it's pulled back away from that key 78 plus area, and but not really showing enough weakness until we get back below, let's call it 77 to 76.50 to suggest that we're headed towards the range low there. And then on the momentum and trend evolution chart on the right, you see that big negative momentum change in the yen that I've put a red rectangle around. And then gold, we're also sensitive, as always, to moves in yields. And on that account, we're getting yet another sort of deflation in the gold price here.
Yeah, we are indeed, John, and you're absolutely right. From one FX sensitive, or the most sensitive in FX, to interest rates, to the most sensitive in the commodities, that's clearly gold. And we are drifting lower once again. I think the market performance so far has been quite disappointing, as you can see here on slide 9. We had that double bottom break above that 60-65 level. We are just kissing that area of support as we record this podcast. And the driver, right, the renewed driver is clearly the treasury yield pickup that Althea mentioned. Depending on where you draw the lines, I've kind of looking at almost like a bull flag starting to form that we potentially have already broken to the upside, but we'll let the FOMC speak later today. But in the short term, what we have learned from this breakout is that the long-term trend followers who have been basically looking at that downtrend since last August, they have not been rattled, they have not been shaken down from the tree, they're still short. If we break below that 60-65 area, we could see some renewed weakness. So potentially interesting day ahead for gold as well as silver.
But if you look at the just the chart pattern there, and there is that interest rate sensitivity in gold, you know, look at the consolidation relative to how much the treasury yields have moved. You could say gold is sort of outperforming relative to the what seems to be a far more sensitive Japanese yen. So it's interesting to see if that continues.
Yeah, and part of that story, I think, is the fact that we have actually, during March and also into April, seen a pickup in demand from Asia, especially India and China. The virus now spreading in India may have a dampening impact, but demand, underlying demand, has been quite strong for physical gold. So we'll basically have to see which one comes out on top, but for now, most of the action is clearly in other commodities. And one of them has been the grain markets, where we've seen a phenomenal run-up this past few weeks here into basically April, 25% gain in some like wheat. I just put in for comparison the two, the new crop and the old crop contracts in corn, because corn has really been the one grabbing the attention because of the headlines, because of the levels it has reached within a very short period of time. Just seeing some retracement now over the last 24 hours, and part of that is clearly the market being well into overbought territory. But I think also the fact, some realization that, well, yes, the old crop, i.e. the one that's that which is the May and the July crop contracts, they are troubled by dwindling supplies because the harvest in Brazil is looking pretty dodgy at this moment in time. But the new crop, which is basically the one that's going to be harvested across the Northern Hemisphere this summer and early autumn, it's just simply too early in the season to really start to become a doomsayer. I mean, weather can still change for the better. And with that in mind, we're seeing the spread between old crop and new crop continue to widen, i.e. that the lower, the price in for new crop is trading quite a bit lower than the current contracts.
And then I saw some overview on Twitter. I can't remember who put it out there, but that China's buying in the first quarter this year has been something like 400% in corn,
yeah,
relative to the prior year. So I guess the risk is, if we look over the full cycle through that new crop, if that bumper harvest isn't there and we've depleted stocks,
exactly,
then you're in big trouble later in the year. So it really will be key, this whole planting. There's a lot of nervousness around this planting season.
Absolutely. That is the risk into the autumn. And yeah, there are some reports out of China that they are trying to incentivize switching away from meal and corn to other feed proteins, just because the price has gone to this kind of level. So that may have a dampening impact on sales into the autumn. I think perhaps a little bit considering also what's happening in a complete different area. And I'm just going outside my charts, but some like copper, where we have to be aware that there will be a response from copper scrap supply with prices rallying as much as they've been doing recently. So it's not just a question of demand going up, but potential supply could also, from scrap, maybe not from mining, but from scrap, could alleviate some of the increase in demand.
Yeah, I don't want to get into the weeds, but I think I saw something that 80% of the copper that's ever been mined is still running around. So you're adding to an existing pile when you're talking about copper. So I guess that's the key in the scrap metal market.
Exactly.
There. All right. We're in the middle of a huge earnings season. We need to get back to the equity market, Peter, and some massive names reporting, generally on the positive side, and especially positive besides the Delivery Hero story you mentioned was Alphabet. You've got a couple of things that were interesting there, but take us through the Alphabet slide you have on slide 11.
Yeah, so the Alphabet and Google has had a very benign base effect, or what you want to call it. It was a weak Q1 and Q2 last year, so that obviously will make the year-to-year numbers look very explosive. But we have to compare against expectations. And as you can see, the key points from the Q1 earnings was that earnings per share hit $26, a little bit more than that, versus almost $16 expected. So very profitable quarter for Alphabet, driven by Google, but also YouTube. YouTube saw a 50% growth rate year-to-year on revenue. It's now a $6 billion advertising business on a quarterly basis. So it's run rate including compounding, somewhere between 25 and 30 billion within the next year on a trailing basis. So that's a pretty significant business right there. And it's now more than 10% of group revenue. So it has become pretty, you know, meaningful business for Google. The cloud business also saw strong growth, almost 50% growth as well, $4 billion business now on a quarterly basis, still trailing Amazon Web Services cloud infrastructure business. And as you can see on that small insert here on slide 11, the Google Cloud business is still a loss-making business. And you can see that Google is also losing a lot of money on their other bets, which is where they have Waymo and some of their other bets in it. So, yeah, and we talked about it, John, before we went on the call, actually, that they talked a little bit about Waymo and the CEO that announced his exit in early April. It was, they said it was planned and all of these things. But as I said to you guys before we talked, I think it all the news in the past year, you know, with Uber getting rid of its autonomous vehicle software and Tesla really not making any key breakthrough. We talked about it a couple of months ago when they rolled out the latest version, where all these, you know, clumsy.
They had a really hard time making a left turn, if I recall.
Exactly. and Waymo CEO is leaving after 4.5 years. And this has been touted as one of the most important technologies to solve technology problems to solve for many different reasons. And, you know, a lot of these CEO type people are people with very big egos. So why would you leave such an opportunity? To me, it just, as you said, John, this is so extremely complicated to get right that it's almost impossible, right? I think the autonomous vehicles will come down to earth, and it will never be the game changer for Tesla in the foreseeable future that ARK Invest and Cathie Wood expects. I think the autonomous vehicles will be more the adaptive cruise control, and then maybe we'll get something standardized for highways where it's where you can have maybe sensor input along the highway to guide the cars. But in the current take on it, it's not seems to be working. So
good point there. Also a key point, and this is just a news item that popped up on, I believe it was FT that I saw this morning. And it reminded me about some statements yesterday, and that this whole global minimum tax, and of course Google would be one of these massive companies where they're stuffing as much of their revenue as they can in various low tax districts, and of course all the different revenue being, or the taxation of that revenue being taken out of where it was actually generated has been very controversial. France has its own tax. Canada threatening to implement its 3% of all revenue digital services tax, so-called. As well, if a deal is not done. And that was interesting yesterday because we saw Chrystia Freeland, the Canadian finance minister, saying that this proposal from the U.S. side for this global minimum tax, I'm forgetting the percentage, is it 21%, is a breakthrough moment, quote unquote. And France and Germany also expressing yesterday some interest or a positive a stance on this initiative. So it really looks like this is going forward. Doesn't seem to be affecting a lot of these companies at the moment, but you know, how serious is this as an issue going down the down the line?
Yeah, we'll make some calculations today and put out some examples because it's a bit tricky. So it's a one-time hit, obviously, on earnings right just in front of you as a company when it's implemented, if it's implemented. And at 28%, it would be a big deal for Google because they're running at an effective tax rate close to somewhere between 12 and 16%, give or take, any year. So that's a one-time hit, but then there's also the compounding effect on that high interest, on that higher tax rate. But then the majority of the value of a company comes from its long-term cash flows. And to what extent is a higher corporate tax rate, does it impact the long-term growth rate, or is that dominated by other forces? It's a tricky thing, but we'll make some calculations so people get an idea of how a tax rate, potentially a global minimum tax of 28%, will change the game. But I think we can all agree on that the environment we have had for four decades with these tax havens and a battle for a lower and lower tax rates. I mean, it doesn't really make any sense. The world should be focusing on productivity and creating technology and research and development and not hiring a lot of tax lawyers. So hopefully we can get to a level playing field and then start focusing on what actually matters to the world.
Yeah, and besides that, you know, taxation is one thing, and then there's the whole antitrust angle, which is probably even bigger threat, obviously, for the longer term in terms of profit margins. Okay, let's just take us through today with yet another day with some massive names reporting. You've got the overview on slide 12.
Yeah, so Apple and Facebook obviously are the big ones. They are among the top five largest companies in the S&P 500. So we'll be watching that. Shopify, part of our e-commerce basket, have done really, really well in 2020 as a lot of companies had to, invest even more in an online presence, and Shopify has delivered the entire infrastructure if you happen to be a business and you want to be online. So, and that one will report before the market opens. So Shopify, and which is also one of the biggest companies in Canada, will be a very important key sentiment for that market today. Apple and Facebook after the market, Boeing before the market as well. Very curious to see how they see the game in the aviation going forward here. And then we'll have some small earnings from Spotify and eBay, but the key ones are still Apple, Facebook, and Shopify.
Definitely. And that leaves us with the macro calendar. Really just need to pull out that FOMC meeting tonight. Again, I think they'll be at pains to avoid saying anything. They don't want to give a guidance now. They're in this awkward guidance that we're going to wait for outcomes and to be sure that they're sustained before we change the guidance. But if we're, if we're in front of huge prints on the CPI, this becomes egg on their face as we work through the coming months if they continue to insist on not changing guidance. But I still think it's too early, which means that if they do bring something into the discussion that suggests they're getting uncomfortable with the potential for rising inflation or otherwise, that the market would be surprised. And we'll be watching after yesterday, watching those treasury yield levels like a hawk. So watching that closely tonight, and you can follow my Twitter feed for reactions on that. And I compare the statements, et cetera, this evening, so you can stay tuned for that. You can follow me at John J. Hardy, and also our main Twitter feed is at Saxo Market Call. I think that's a wrap for today, and we'll be back tomorrow to see where things stand post FOMC with the next Saxo Market Call.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter at Saxo Market Call or by email marketcall@saxobank.com.